history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you, and you might never know what these brave Americans did unless you take the time to ask and then listen. And we're really going to illustrate that point today about big or small, because one vet we'll hear from lives in a metropolis that's a worldwide tourist destination, while the other has spent almost his entire life in a tiny town of just a few hundred. It's Father's Day weekend, of course, and in thinking about that, I realize that just about every weekend is Father's Day weekend on Hometown Heroes. If you don't get to hear your own dad or granddad on the show, you'll probably notice some similarities. And if you're fortunate enough to still have your dad around, maybe you pick up some ideas for some questions to ask him before it's too late. If you have lost that veteran in your life, perhaps the stories you hear will help you understand and bring into focus some of the conversations you never got to have. Anyway, in honor of Father's Day, we're going to hear from two different dads, and one of them you've already met if you listened to our last episode. We weren't able to fit in all of Mel Pliner's story last time, so we're going to catch the rest today. He's a native of Brooklyn, spent much of his post-war life in New Mexico, and now lives in Las Vegas with his daughter Carol, who we're also going to hear from today. Mel was a glider pilot during World War II. You can pick up the podcast from last time at hometownheroesradio.com, but we left off with the story of his final mission, the one that earned him the Purple Heart. He had already safely landed powerless planes in the Normandy invasion, in the invasion of southern France, and in Holland. This time, it was late March 1945, and Operation Varsity served as the last airborne deployment of the war in Europe. Also the largest ever airborne operation conducted on one day in a single target area, and the objective was the Rhine River.
Okay, we get ready to approach the Rhine River, drop down to 500. As we cross the river, I couldn't see the Weitzel, but before we took off, I was assigned a bazooka, and my co-pilot had a vest, three rockets in front, three rockets behind for the bazooka.
Right.
We were going to land close to a main intersection highway where we were supposed to join other troops to set up a defense to keep any resupplies from getting to the troops
right
in the front line.
Cutting their supply line.
Cross the Rhine, drop down, green light, red light, and I cut loose. And here's a big field, I don't know how many acres, big power lines with the high towers across the field, and gliders. Some of them hit the wires. So I figured, well, okay, I cut loose, and I'm heading for that, and I got a place where there's room for me to land my glider. I'm 200 feet high, and I'm holding the wheel like this, and some krauts, a bird shooter. Now, you know, most of the krauts were aiming at the pilot's compartment, and it was going to the tail section. This guy's a bird shooter. You know how you lead birds?
Yeah.
He was a bird shooter. I'm sitting like that, and he gets me right through the arm between the radius and the other.
Still have a scar
see
there?
See that?
Uh-huh.
That's where it came out.
Oh.
I said, take over, I'm hit.
So guys, this is your co-pilot who's never done this before.
He froze.
Can't function.
I pull up the spoiler and held it up with my left foot, and I landed it with my left hand and my right foot.
Because your right hand, you can't do anything
my
with.
My right hand hit. Fell down.
It's useless.
Into shock.
So you're landing this glider one-handed.
One-handed, 1 foot. Of course, I was only about 200 feet high. When I did that, evidently, I took and wiped out the gear on my right side. Just came right off. Because over there, the fields, about every 15 furrows, was a deep one to carry any moisture off the field instead of washing the grass off over to a ravine, a little ravine over there. Came to stop with the left wheel in the ravine and my right wing about a foot or two above the ground. By that time, all the troops had gotten out, and my co-pilot came to life, and he got out. I had on a flak vest. Now, a flak vest,
yeah,
it's got two snaps on each shoulder.
Right.
And it's got a belt around the waist with snaps. Supposed to be able to give it one good jerk and it's supposed to fall off.
Right.
Well, with my arm in shock, I'm pulling with my left hand, and it didn't come off. And I got scared, because with that thing on, you don't move very well.
It's
heavy. I gave
it
a second pull, and it came off, and I got out and got underneath.
Spurt.
This wound in your arm is spraying blood everywhere.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I get out to get out my first aid kit.
Because you're all alone. Everybody else is left.
Got out, put a bandage. I put it around here to stop the bleeding.
Uh-huh. You had to give yourself first aid.
Yeah. About 30, 40 minutes, my co-pilot is lying on there. And this guy, he wants to get up and run. I says, hell, you wouldn't run 15, 20 feet and they'd shoot you. Because there was still a lot of rifle fire. But it wasn't too long after our troops started to take over and the rifle fire started to just about quiet down. Shortly after that, a squad of American troops was crossing the field. I said, now's the time to get up and get in the middle of it. And we started yelling and screaming. And about 13 troops turned around with their rifles. American troops, hey, guy! Showed them the American flag on our shoulder. And we got in the middle of them. We got down to the ravine there, and there were other glider pilots there, troops. And there was a first aid guy. Mm-hmm. He saw I had this. He's, what happened to you? I said, I got one through the arm. He said, let me take a look. Took a look at it, put some sulfur, whatever it was, wrapped it, gave me a sling. He said, how does it feel? I said, hurts like hell. He says, here's a morphine syringe. Stick it in your arm. And he says, it'll keep you from hurting, slow you down. I says, I don't want it. If I got to move out, I want to be able to move out, which we did. I started to head back towards the Rhine River. And in so doing, I'm walking up the ravine, and I come across a house. And right in front of the house is a German doctor with two troops standing there watching them. And he's got a steamer trunk with all kinds of medications and operating tools. Could have performed major surgery there. And he's working on a paratrooper. The paratrooper's got his foot up on the back of a chair with his middle toe missing. Now, whether he shot it off or what, probably.
To get himself out of the line of fire?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doctor's sewing it up, and he's got a cigar in his mouth and a .45 on his foot. He says, Doc, he says, if you hurt me, I'm going to blow your brains out. Doctor doesn't understand a word of English.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, sewed him up. Gave him a couple of pairs of crutches, and off he went. Called me over, looked, took that off. He went over there, and he got a big stick with something on it, stuck it in there. And I thought he was going to just, I was just dying, just wrap it, which he did. Made my way over to the shores of the Rhine River, where there was a first aid station, and there was a nurse in there. What happened to you, Lieutenant? I said, I got one in the arm. Took it off, look at it. More powder. By then, the bleeding was starting to slow down. It was bleeding a little bit, but it wasn't a spurt.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened, it went through the radiation ulna, and it didn't break any bones, but it hit the nerve to the thumb. You see the difference in the size?
Ah, okay.
Hit the nerve to the thumb.
Uh-huh.
She looked at it like that. By that time, it was starting to get dark. She said, take a towel there and get out there and find a place to lie down, get some sleep, and tomorrow we'll get you out of here across the river. So I take a blanket. By now, it's dark. A couple of guys out there. Pardon me. So I lay the blanket down. It's dark, and I lie down in that thing, and I bring it over me. And it feels like there's a 2x4 right underneath my back. By that time, she had given me a shot, and I fell asleep. I got up the next morning to see what the hell was under my back. Well, you know how mud slides up between dual wheels on a truck and dries up? Hell, I could have ooched for 40 miles and never got away from it. But anyway, I got up, gave it a towel back. By that time, they had some ducks. You know what a duck is?
Yeah.
Come across back and forth. So I got in the front seat of the duck, and they had some stretcher guys. They put in the duck, and across the river we went to a real first aid station where they had some doctors, but they didn't have any x-ray machines. So when the doctor looked at mine, he figured, well, it must have hit one of the bones.
He figured to get hit there with their bones so tightly worked there, it had to break something.
So he put it in a cast.
Uh-huh.
So here I am in a cast. Well, By that time, there was a little airstrip there. They were flying troops out of there. And he said, what hospital do you want to go to, in Paris or London? I says, London. So I was flown, and when I got to the hospital, they put me in a ward for bone fractures, stuff like that. And I was in a ward all by myself. I was there for 30 days.
Yeah.
During which time, the war in Europe was over. I figured I'll stay in London. And I had some English money, and after my money ran out and I couldn't withdraw any more money, I had to get on an airplane and fly over to Paris, where I called the base. They sent the Jeep out. The Jeep took me back to the air base where we were stationed, A-55. Place was deserted. Everybody was gone. Well, wasn't too long after that. Troops started to come back when their money ran out. And we were told to get ready, that we were going to be transported by train to Brussels, where we were going to get a ship to take us back to the States. And when we got there, I was assigned some ship. I don't remember the name of it, but it was a cargo ship, one of the ships that they had built to bring goods over to England, you know. In the holds, the forward hold and the aft hold, they had built racks with beds in them, cots. And I don't know how many they could put in the forward and aft, but when we got on board the ship, I was assigned one of the holds with these cots in it. And so I climbed down the ladder, got into that thing where my B4 bag and a duffel bag that I had some stuff in. And after we left port, I got back up and I went up to the cruise compartment and I talked to the steward. And I said, did you know my father, David Pliner, Sunrise Steamship Laundry? He says, yeah, I knew him. Well, I'm his son. I'm one of the troops down in the hold. He says, bring your gear up here and we'll put you in one of the cruise quarters. And I went into one of the cruise quarters. And I don't know how long the trip across the ocean was, but I went to the slop chest, got a pair of jeans and a shirt, and I was one of the crew for the duration of the trip. Had a nice place to eat, with the crew 3 meals a day. We were about a couple of hours out of New York City when we were coming into the harbor, and I figured, well, I better get back down there. So I changed back into my uniform. I got back there and said, where the hell have you been? I said, none of your business.
Never heard that story before, have you? It's something new every time. And we're not quite done with Mel. I want you to hear about his experience 65 years after D-Day, when he got to return to Normandy, and also about his most recent mission with Honor Flight Southern Nevada to Washington, D.C. His daughter Carol was his guardian on that trip, and we're going to hear from her as well. And then we'll meet another World War II veteran from a tiny little pit stop in northern New Mexico. Maybe Father's Day is an opportunity to explore the military service of your own dad or grandpa. Don't miss that opportunity, and don't miss the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.